And I have I believe, an interesting and important lesson to share with you about the demon-possessed man. I got most of the ideas and the outline from this lesson from a lecture I went to by Wade Webster. I'll mention that. And if you open up in your Bibles, you're really going to have three verses marked so that we can jump back and forth between these three passages. Matthew 8, 28-34, Mark 5, and Luke 8. This is one of the accounts where the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, actually give quite a few supplementary information that differs from one another. And so you have to compare all three passages to get the full story. Mark's is the longest, and we'll look at his the most. Matthew's the shortest, and Luke adds some other things as well. I think we often talk about the question, if Jesus came back today, would people believe in him? Would the reaction to him be different than it was in the first century? In other words, if Jesus would have come in our time period instead of the time period he did come, how would we react to him? I know in Bible class this morning, Michael, in teaching us, was talking some about the apostles and how they saw all these miracles and how in some ways they were slow to understand. And we always ask the question, what would it be like if we were in those situations? Would we be like them? Tonight's story is interesting because I think in many ways, our nation and the people of our communities would have the same reaction that these people did if Jesus got in to our pocketbooks and asked us to change our lives the way he's asking them. There was a poem that I wanted to read that I thought was good by John Oxenham about this encounter of the demon-possessed man. He writes this, "Rabbi, be gone. Thy powers bring loss to us and ours. Our ways are not as thine. Thou lovest men, we swine. Oh, get you hence, omnipotence, and take this fool of thine. His soul, what care we for his soul? What good to us that thou hast made him whole, since we have lost our swine? And Christ went sadly, he had wrought for them a sign of love and hope and tenderness divine. They wanted swine. Christ stands without your door and gently knocks, but if your gold or swine the entrance blocks, he forces no man's hold. He will depart and leave you to the treasures of your heart." In our story, let's read Mark's account so that we'll get the story. As I mentioned, it's one of the longer accounts. Matthew actually mentions that there were two men. Mark and Luke only mention one. Maybe he's the more prominent one. Maybe he's the louder one. But for whatever reason, Matthew mentions two. This happens in another occasion. One time Matthew mentions two blind men, where Mark and Luke only mention one. It might be that Matthew was just a tax collector and he didn't miss any heads. And so he counted two. It may be that one was just a lesser importance in his significance in the story. Either way, don't be confused. Matthew mentions two, Mark and Luke only one man. Beginning in verse 1, they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. Jesus, who had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit, some demons, as other accounts are given. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Day and night among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, crying out with a loud voice and said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out of him and entered the pigs. In Matthew's account, Jesus uses one word to command them to go into the pigs. They ask permission to go to the swine. Jesus says, "Go." And they all go into the swine. And the number of the pigs numbered about 2,000. And they rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it to the city and the country. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it described to them that what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus, "Depart from this region." And he was getting into the boat. The man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis how much Jesus had done with him. And everyone marveled. I want to note three different aspects of our story. There is, first of all, the men or the man who are miserably possessed. Then we'll notice the Messiah who was mightily confessed. Finally, we'll observe the multitude who were materially obsessed. Notice the men who were miserably possessed. They had horrible lives. They were intended to be the temple of God. They were created in the image of God. And I know there's a lot of questions. In fact, in our Q&A session a few weeks ago, I answered some things about demons. We may have a lot of questions about this passage. But the key idea I think we need to see is some men who are not what God intended them to be. For whatever reason, and I believe that it is that God allowed at this time demons and Satan to have a more powerful presence so that Jesus could demonstrate his power in the spiritual realm over the demonic world and to show that he is the great God over the spiritual kingdoms as well as over the natural kingdom. But we see men who are miserable. The term legion, as they describe themselves and name themselves, refers probably to a Roman legion, which could number up to 6,000 soldiers. A small legion, the lowest basically a legion could become, was 3,000. So it's saying that this is not just one demon, but this is, as the text says, many, probably thousands of demons. When you think about this, these demons, this is a force that no man could resist. And it's a force that allowed them to have supernatural strength so that they could break the chains and the shackles that bound them. But notice this as well, verse 5, that the man who still had some amount of rationale and what we might say his human spirit upon him, cut himself. That is, he chose to create pain to try to avoid the emotional and other spiritual pain he was feeling from the demons. I know cutting is still a problem for people today. Sometimes it is a way that people that are having serious emotional problems or someone who's trying to get attention will act out and cut themselves. Sometimes that's done as a way of even trying to divert the inner conflict by hurting yourself physically or maybe punishing yourself physically. They were trying to cut themselves. We must ask the question, how bad does life get? When you think about the pain of these men, how bad does life have to be in order to try to dull it? Some people are in that situation today, aren't they? Where life is so bad that they will resort to drugs, and alcohol, to try to just dull the pain. Or maybe they will resort to some type of physical cutting or harming themselves to try to get some relief from what's going on inside. Sometimes even people will get very angry and upset at us or you. And we need to often ask the question, maybe it's not what you did is why they're so upset, but maybe it's something going on in them that causes them to flare out at you. And what can we do to help them? Another idea here is that in many ways this is a picture of hell. Think about the demons here, which are going to be in hell and being reserved here. But there's many similarities. For example, day and night, and that's similar to Jesus talking about that there's no end to the wailing and gnashing of teeth in hell and darkness and things. If you read over in Mark chapter 9, you'll find that in some ways it's eerily similar, where Jesus talks about in verses 42 through 48, when he describes hell, that the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched, and there's the gnashing of teeth. These demons who had occupied the body of this man represent and show us a picture of hell. These demons did not want Jesus to do to them what they were doing to this man. Now think about that. In Matthew chapter 8, verse 28, Matthew 8, verse 28, the demons will say this to Jesus. Verse 28, they met him coming out of the tomb so fierce that no one could pass. Verse 29, they cried out, "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us?" The demons were afraid that Jesus was going to torment them. In fact, in Luke's account, they beg Jesus not to send them to the abyss or to hell. See, we think that hell is Satan's playpen. That Satan likes hell, that the demons like hell, but they don't. Hell is the place of punishment for the demons. 2 Peter and Jude talks about the angels who are reserved under punishment. And Satan knows that he has but a short time, Revelation 12, so he has gone to make war with the saints. He knows what his end is. He knows that he's going to be thrown into, Revelation 20, into the lake of fire, the second death. He knows that he's going to be punished. And these demons are begging Jesus, "Don't send us to the abyss. Don't send us into punishment." You know, there's a lot of similarities there as well to many people that are involved in sin. People don't want what they're doing to others. For example, the abortionist wants his life and his rights protected, yet he will work hard to try to take another's life. The criminal wants their rights protected while they are violating other people's rights. The homosexual wants their voice heard while they're trying to silence our speech in a biblical way and calling it hate speech. You see, these demons don't want to happen to them what they're doing to someone else. It is right the opposite of the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. These demons are doing what they don't want to have done to them. And then I want to note one other comparison, and then we're going to notice Jesus. And this is a really good comparison, I believe. If you look at Ephesians chapter 2, and you lay that beside the parable of the story, and I know this story is not a parable, it's a real story, but what I'm saying is you lay it beside the lesson and see it as explaining Ephesians 2, I think it's helpful. Notice how Ephesians 2, which is describing us, could be used to describe legion. Verse number 1, "You were dead in trespasses and sins." Where is this man living? In the tombs. His life is basically dead. And notice, "in which you walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air and the spirit that's now at work in the sons of disobedience. Lived in the passions of your flesh, carrying out the desires of your mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind." These demons were living a horrible life, and these men were living a despicable, pitiful life. I tried to find a picture to put up to represent this parable,
And I decided I couldn't put a picture up because we know, probably don't notice this, but they were naked. The men were naked out there in shackles and chains, living out in the desert, cutting themselves. Not a picture you want to show to the church. Didn't want to get in trouble on that one. But that's the graphic scene that we have here. They were dead. And then if you go on, notice verse 4. But God, being rich in mercy because of the great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. They are saved by the grace of Jesus, by the mercy of God. And then notice as you can continue to read down in verse number 10, for we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus. What do we see at the end of the story? These men are sitting at the feet of Jesus, and they become the only missionaries to this area. Jesus leaves, and He leaves these two men in Decapolis and in this region to spread the gospel to the whole region. You see, in fact, if you go on down to verse 12, remember that at the time you were separated from Christ, these men were separated from society, separated from the world. Yet now through Christ, they have been brought, verse number 13, near by the blood of Christ. We don't like to think of ourselves like these men. But in many ways, a sinner who is apart from the blood of Jesus is pictured in these men. Not literal demon possessions, I'm not advocating or teaching that. But their life is ruled by sin, by the demons of the world. Maybe there are emotional and guilt and sin that rules their life. And they are dead in sin. And it's only through the grace of God that they can be reborn and created anew and can sit at the feet of Jesus and can then be His missionary and go and tell what good things God has done for them. Now let's notice the Messiah mightily confessed. Matthew chapter 8, verse 29. These demons will cry out for the Messiah, saying, O Son of God, what have we to do with you? In James chapter 2, verse 19, you know the verse that talks about how the demons believe and tremble. Notice what these demons did not know. They did not know that they were in a league with Jesus. Later on in Matthew chapter 12, verses 22 to 29, the Pharisees will talk about when Jesus heals another man. They say, how can Jesus do that? They say He does that through the power of Beelzebub. In other words, they say Jesus is in league with the demons. And Jesus will say, well, if I'm in partnership with Satan, then, you know, we're working against each other here. And He'll talk about that concept about how if I'm not in league with Satan, then the power of the kingdom has come upon you. Notice that the Pharisees might have thought Jesus was getting His power by Beelzebub, by Satan. But the demons didn't think it. The demons knew they were opposed to Jesus. They knew who He was. Just like James says, the demons believe and tremble. They say, O Son of God, the Jewish people of these townspeople, they didn't get it, but the demons got it. The demons were not in a league with Jesus. Also notice that they knew who He was. They knew more about Jesus than the Jews, and they were closer to salvation than the Jews were. And I've already observed, notice that they didn't want to go to the abyss. And ultimately, they had to submit, and I think this is one of the purposes of demons in the New Testament, to the authority of Jesus. In Matthew, he illustrates this for us by they have to ask permission. They beg permission to go into the swine. They were afraid they were going to be sent to the chains of the abyss. And they couldn't break those chains. But Jesus commands them to go to the swine. Now that brings up other questions. What happens to them after the swine drown? Things of that nature. I don't know. But the idea is they submitted to the authority of Jesus. You know, ultimately, everyone is going to have to submit to the authority of Jesus. They confessed, but their confession was really a weak confession in that it didn't change their life. Think of the change in these men now that the demons are gone. They went from crazy to sane, from cutting themselves to calm and hope-filled, from attacking other people and not allowing anybody to pass, to sitting at the feet of Jesus and telling others about Jesus. In Luke 8, verse 35, it talks about these men and the change that was wrought in them. Notice we find out in verse 35, then people went out to see what had happened when they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. You see, what we see in this is the change that the Messiah, who when he is mightily confessed, when we have faith in him, the change he can bring in our life. Warren Wiersbe, in his commentary, talks about, this is kind of interesting, I think, it makes a good point. What Satan did to the men, he ruined them and filled them with demons. Let me tell you something. That is exactly what Satan wants to do to you. Satan is fine with you being passed out on the street because of alcohol. Satan is fine with you spending your last dollar on some drug. Satan is fine with you being greedy and lustful in a physical or sexual way. Satan is fine with all the misery he can bring upon you. Satan is fine with you filing divorce papers. Satan is fine, and you fill in the blank, when it comes to whatever misery you might fear. Satan wants to bring that upon you. You see, these men are a picture of what Satan wants to do to you. But then think about this. Think about what society did to the man. Society said, he doesn't fit. He's got problems. Let's get him out. Let's put him in the asylum. Let's lock him up. You see, society said, let's get him out. Let's protect ourselves. And I understand society has to do that in certain ways. But society put the demon-possessed man out. Now here's the question that makes the most